Okay, well, so I hope you all had a nice weekend. I wanted to mention, I sent an email out, but turns out that something came up for Adam that he cannot get out of on Friday. So his section, I mean, he can't make his section, and he's been trying to get in touch with the rest of us for the last few days, and finally this morning it became apparent that Guangyi and Scott and I cannot cover for him on Friday. So we're going to cancel the Friday section. If you can go to the Monday or Wednesday sections, go ahead and do it. I understand that not everyone can do that, so we are going to try to set up a different time. I was emailing Adam. He's looking at times Wednesday evening. And if you know that you can't make Monday or Wednesday and Friday's the only time you can do it, let me know, and I'll try to check with you to make sure that when we set up the makeup that at least we're choosing a time when in principle you can make it there. So, about the best I can do. You okay? Yes?
If it happens that you can't make any of the sessions for this week, even the makeup one, can we penalize for it?
If in the end it makes a difference, let me know. I mean, there's forgiveness built in the syllabus, but if you've used up that forgiveness with other things and this, in fact, would penalize you, then I'm not going to keep track of it, but you let me know, and then I'll correct it if I need to. If it changes a grade, then we'll change the grade. Okay? Anything else? You guys have any questions on your mind? Stuff you've been thinking about? All right. So just so you know, the stuff we've been talking about, you know, it's highly popular stuff. See, even Teen Vogue is all into it. Maybe you had to be there, but I was highly amused when I saw this cover. Okay. So we've been talking about cosmology. I think we're finally really getting into the meat of what I would consider the meat of the class. And if you recall, when we started talking about cosmology, the starting place is really the fact that we live in an expanding universe. And we get the expanding universe from looking at the recession velocity of all the galaxies and the fact that it increases as they're further away. And so to get that data, you require two pieces. One is an estimate of how far the galaxy is away from us, and the other is how fast it's going. So the how far you get from the basic standard candle idea that there's a certain type of supernova that will happen in all galaxies. I mean, you do make an assumption that the world of physics is the same in some galaxy far away as it is here. Okay? And we're actually going to examine that assumption later in this class, because when it comes to multiple universes, that's not necessarily going to follow. But within our universe, the physical laws are thought to be all the same. Yeah?
So, when we were talking last time, you were saying there might be multiple black holes and coming out of other universes. You had a diagram up there.
Right.
A bunch of them coming out of each other. That's all in one universe? Or is that a multi-universe idea?
For simplicity, let's start with one universe. Mm-hmm. For this particular multi-universe concept, which I call the fecund universe that we discussed, let us just start with one, and let us suppose that the physical laws in this one are such that stars can develop and that black holes can develop. If black holes happen within this universe, when a black hole happens, we are causally disconnected from that. And within that, Lee Smolin calculates that you could have the space collapse and then rebound, and then when it rebounds, it can look within that space like you're experiencing what we would call our universe, an expanding universe. And the fact that it's completely causally disconnected from us, from our point of view, it's a little bit like a ship in the bottle sort of thing, but it's not really, because it is totally disconnected from us space-time-wise once the black hole forms. So But it is a bit one universe begats others, and the physical characteristics are passed on in the quantum fluctuations that happen when this bounce happens. So that if you're in a universe that is likely to form black holes, you will form universes within those black holes that will form, that are more likely to form black holes. So that is a multi-universe concept, because basically you have these disconnected realities. They happen to have some relation. If you were able to step outside of this whole thing and look at linear time, you would sort of see this thing happening, but you can't do that. And defining time, I mean, time gets really weird at that boundary. I mean, what does that really mean? And certainly the time doesn't start for that daughter universe until the black hole is formed, but the time of our universe doesn't carry through into that that new space. So I don't know what it really means. So the whole idea of relating time between universes and some of these concepts is pretty wacky. And we're going to see something today that's even a little bit stranger, but if that's hard to imagine. Okay, so yeah, that's a multi-universe concept that I'm calling the Fecan multiverse. Okay, so and it is a bit really pulled out of thin air. I mean, it's an interesting idea that Smolin's got, and it is motivated by what we really believe is a good working theory of gravity and general relativity. So he's using general relativistic equations. We know black holes exist. He is speculating as to what's happening in a black hole. We don't have core scientific knowledge of what's going on inside a black hole. And we really don't have solid scientific theories what happens when things collapse to a basic singularity and quantum gravity comes into play. So he is speculating through that stage. Now, it's somewhat educated speculation. It's his area of research. So he's actually on the cutting edge of trying to figure out what's going on. So it's not completely pulled out of thin air, but in a sense it sort of is. So this isn't as well supported a multiverse concept as I'm about to say, but it is not divorced from science as we know it. It actually is a reasonable science. And one of the things that makes it an interesting scientific hypothesis is because universes that are prone to make black holes are prone to create universes that are prone to make black holes. It has a form of natural selection in it where if this is the way the multiverse worked, you would most likely be in a universe where you're optimal for black hole production, which is a very specific statement that this model makes, because according to the Copernican principle that we started out with, that our universe, or where we are in the universe, can't be special, that wherever you are, you should perceive it to be the same way. In the same sense, when we talk about multiple universes, scientifically, you assume that our universe must be typical for the distribution of universes within the multiverse. And if that's true, then it would mean our universe needs to be optimal for black hole production if that model is true. So it makes a hardcore scientific hypothesis, which can be disproven in principle. In practice, people argue about it. So I don't know whether it's true or not. Okay? So we were talking about stuff that's really not so speculative. So this black hole idea, the Fecan multiverse, is clearly speculation and fun and part of the class. But the idea that we live in an expanding universe is pretty well established scientifically. It comes from two places. One is we have to know how far the galaxies are away from us, and the other is we have to know how fast they're moving away from us. And the picture is that the further away a galaxy is, the faster it's moving away from us. That's what the data actually tells us. And the way we get the distance is by looking at the brightness. When supernovas go off in distant galaxies, they're extremely bright, so we can see them. They go off over a fairly short period of time, so we can actually observe the brightness increase and fall off. And the way in which that brightness increases and falls off time-wise actually tells us what type of supernova it was. And there are types of supernovas by looking at that light intensity curve, we can actually know what the absolute luminosity or the absolute amount of light that's emitted happens to be, which basically means we can know how bright it was. And if we know how bright it was, when we measure how bright it looks to us, we have a measure of how far away it is. Because when things are bright and you move them far away, they get dimmer, and we can understand that. So that's how you determine how far away it is. The way in which you determine the recession velocity is to look at the spectral lines, right? If you know that there are certain types of gases, like hydrogen, in a galaxy, we know what colors the hydrogen spectral lines are if the gas is sitting still with respect to us. If it moves, it turns out those lines get shifted. If it's moving away from us, they get shifted in the red. So they get, and the degree of shifting is more if it's moving away from us. So here is the same thing for sound. All right? So we have a constant pitch being emitted by this thing at the end of the boom. All right? And now you can hear how the pitch is modulated depending on whether it's moving toward you or away from you. And if I make it go faster, the modulation is more. Right? So in the case of light, instead of hearing a different pitch, you see a different color, right? And the faster it's moving away or toward you determines what you see. So that's the Doppler shift for sound. Okay? All right, so the minute that you believe in this crazy picture that all of the space in the universe is expanding, then you get the bizarre fact that as we go back in time, so this is today, as we go back in time, the universe becomes more densely packed and becomes hotter. The average interaction between particles in the universe becomes much more energetic. And so that actually changes the mixture and character of the particles that exist out in space or in the universe, and it changes the way in which they interact. So the nature of the forces and the types of particles actually change as we go back in time. So if we start really early, and I'm going to omit this section for the moment, so we're gonna not deal with the first 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang for the moment. Yeah.
Does it expand in all directions?
Yeah. It's like, think of raisin dough, raisin bread dough, literally just, and that's how you get that things that are further from you expand faster away from you, because all the dough in between two distant raisins is expanding, so they'll move apart faster than raisins that are close together because there's less dough expanding, so they'll move apart but not as fast. So that's why the data tells us that the space is expanding. Excuse me. So let's start at a pretty early time, what is far closer to the start of things than we can possibly imagine, like 10 to the minus 35 seconds. But at that stage, we actually begin to have actual data on what the universe should have been like. And at that point, massive particles, the mass doesn't matter so much because the interactions between the particles is so energetic that the fact that some particles are massive and some aren't just doesn't matter so much. So at the early stages of the universe, we have basically a soup of subatomic particles. Things like protons and neutrons can't hold together. There's no such thing as a neutral atom. Light can't travel very far because it gets absorbed by charged particles. Then as things get a bit cooler, then, let me see where we are here. We get into a regime where we have lots of accelerators that are actually studying. So this isn't, I mean, we begin to speculate a little bit as we go further and further back. But at this stage, at about 10 to the minus 10 seconds, we are literally studying things, actually closer to 10 to the minus 18 seconds at the LHC. We are literally studying processes that we believe would have been present in the universe at that time. So the fun, in a sense, for this class begins at about a microsecond when the quarks and gluons, those things that make up neutrons and protons, will, when the universe cools enough, they'll actually condense into protons and neutrons. Once you have a gas of protons and neutrons, the neutrons will tend to stick to the protons and create larger nuclei. There's sort of a tendency to do that. You have a limited amount of time for that to happen, though, once the neutrons form, because free neutrons will decay. They'll decay into protons and electrons, okay? So there's a finite time over which you can form light nuclei, and that happens at around 3 minutes. So somewhere between, 100 seconds and 3 minutes, some light nuclei form. And the universe ends up being mostly hydrogen because the neutrons mostly decay and you have protons there. Then you have some light elements like beryllium, lithium, and the such. If we can do calculations, people understand nuclear physics, you can put this mess in a pot and cook it in your computer simulations and ask what comes out in the end as this thing cools down from this high temperature. And you can get exact predictions as to what the ratio of these different elements should be, and people see this. So another major reason to believe in the Big Bang. So that's happening right in here. We get these light nuclei formed. The other thing that's going on in here that's really relevant to us is that the universe is opaque through this whole time, up to about 300,000 years after the 300,000 to 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And the reason it's opaque is because it's got a lot of freely charged particles. It's not full of neutral particles. The reason for that is because although we have electrons and these positive nuclei, the protons and the light nuclei, you can't hold together neutral atoms when you are at a temperature of above about 3,000 degrees. The moment the universe hits about 3,000 degrees, then you get what is called, in a somewhat misleading term, recombination, and that comes from a different area of physics. It's hard to call it recombination since the nuclei and the electrons had never been together before, but that's what it's called. So we have recombination, which is where neutral atoms now form. And when that happens, the photons no longer get absorbed or scattered by everything that's in the universe. So the universe goes from being opaque to radiation to being completely transparent. So in this great universe at that time, or the reality of, might be much larger than our observable universe, all of a sudden light that's bouncing around can stream freely. And we can actually now look out in all directions and see that light coming to us from this part of the universe at about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So that's about 13.2 billion years ago. And that light has traveled to us freely since that time, and we call it the cosmic microwave background. The fact that we see it, the fact that it has exactly the characteristics of this light in that it is the frequency distribution of the light as we would expect it in this scenario, is another huge reason to believe in the Big Bang. Yes?
So I have a little silly, but could light ever disappear? Because when you think about it, like why isn't the universe just completely flooded with light? Because there's so many stars.
It does change frequency, right? So as the universe expands, the way it's explained is that the actual wavelength of the light is expanding too. There's another way to look at it that makes more sense to me, but I think it actually has a fallacy in it, which is as we look at things that are farther and farther away, they're emitted by things moving faster and faster from us. So in a sense, if we're looking at the part of the universe that's 13.2 billion light years away, it wasn't at that time because it's been expanding during that period, but it would be moving away from us very fast. So that actually turns out to be not, and that means it would redshift it down into the microwaves, which is where we see. So the light that is emitted, it's at about 3,000 degrees. So if you had an object that was at 3,000 degrees and you looked at the light that was emitted by that, it would be in the UV mostly. And instead what we see is in the microwaves. But the way to think about that is because as that light has traveled, literally the space has been expanding, and it literally expands the wavelength. And so that happens. So it is true that anything that's emitted in the visible, we wouldn't see as visible because its wavelength is changing. But I think there's a, your question is actually a very deep one, and people have puzzled over it. If in fact the universe is infinite and the stars continue forever, or the galaxies, then why is it that basically the night sky isn't blinding white? I mean, and the reason for that is with the expanding universe, there comes a point where effectively it's receding from us faster than light can travel, which means there's a finite region which can be part of our observable universe. So there's a finite region of the universe where light can actually come to us. So we're not in a, it's not the same as infinitely far away. There are other factors that you can think about. There are things in the universe that can absorb light, gas and such. But for the purposes of this, the cosmic microwave background effectively comes free streaming to us. Yeah?
Didn't gamma rays undergo a redshift? Like, could a gamma ray turn into a UV ray?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And in fact, one of the first and interesting one of the most interesting measurements in my mind that supports general relativity is in Harvard, they took a nucleus that naturally radioactively decays down at the bottom of the tower of their physics building, and they detected it up at the top. And as I mentioned in general relativity, there's a prediction that as you move up in a gravitational field, you get redshifted as well. It's not just a velocity thing. And they are able to measure the frequency up here to be slightly different from down there, but that was done with gamma rays coming off of these nuclei. All right, so this is a crazy picture. And I guess most of this I've now mentioned, so... The light of the cosmic microwave background was discovered in the 1960s. It's a perfect black body, basically meaning it glows from all directions. Yes?
How do you see light from the background? What does that mean?
It means that we are detecting light that has been traveling since that time and happens to see us. You've actually seen it. If you turn on in the old days, if you turned on an analog television, a good bit of the static that you would see was actually signals coming from the cosmic microwave background. So I never knew it at the time, but it turns out to be true. At any rate, what does it mean to see a star that's 4 light years away? It means we are seeing light that was emitted by that star 4 years ago, and it has traveled to us for that 4 years of time because of the distance. So that's what we're seeing with the cosmic microwave background. It's light that basically was present in the universe at that time that has traveled freely for 13 point some billion years and finally hits Earth and our detector. No, it's light, just like this, except a different color. I mean, if you take the hydrogen gas, or you know those little gas things that we did where you were looking at spectra, the hydrogen one, for example, imagine a universe at that temperature all glowing that color. Individual photons couldn't go very far because they hit gas. And they get reabsorbed and everything. So it's opaque. So you can't image in a universe like that. But now, all of a sudden, you switch it to the point where it's transparent to light. the photons that happen to be moving in the universe at that moment, and at any given time there's, you know, a countless number of photons that are in transit from one point to another, they just keep going because all of a sudden the universe becomes transparent. And so we happen to be in a place, I mean, no matter where you are, those photons, some of them will actually hit you and you can detect them. So that's what we're detecting. So when you detect them, you will see them coming from all directions. If you look at the intensity as a function of frequency, you would get this, where this is a measure of the frequency and this is the intensity. This curve looks exactly like you would get for black body radiation. So something glowing has a very distinct curve that we understand very well in quantum mechanics. And if we look at the number of the different types of nuclei, this is a prediction. These are the expected fractions of total amount of normal matter in the universe as a function of time at the start of the universe on out. And you see how they all become basically independent of time for the most part. So those ratios are well predicted, and we see that in intergalactic space using astronomical techniques. So we believe that the vast majority of what we're made of, the hydrogen in the universe, comes from the earliest stages of the Big Bang, when the protons are formed at a microsecond after the start of the Big Bang. Some of the light nuclei come from Big Bang nucleosynthesis at this early stage of the Big Bang. All the rest, and most of the light nuclei, and certainly all the rest of the nuclei up to iron, comes from mostly from synthesis inside of stars due to fusion. And then when stars go supernova, you get all the rest plus some of the light ones, because you have this massive amount of energy that allows synthesis to happen. So depending on what element you're talking about, the source is actually quite different. Okay? All right, there are lots of problems with this picture, even though it is actually pretty well supported experimentally. One of the problems, as we'll find, and I'm going to let the story develop a little bit today, so I'm not going to tell you exactly how we know this, but in general relativity, space can be curved, so this is well known, and since we're supposed to be living in a universe that is not supposed to be special in any sense, if general relativity allows curvatures of all types, you would expect our universe to have space that's basically curved in some way. If we go and we look at it, it turns out to be flat, and how we make that measurement we'll talk about later today. But that means that we're living in a universe that's very close to a special case. And there is nothing inherent in the Big Bang model in and of itself that drives the geometry of the universe to be flat. So that is a problem with the Big Bang in and of itself. Another problem is what happens when you go back in time and you have all this energy in our universe and you go back to a single point. I mean, physics as we know it breaks down. So there's a real problem there. We don't understand quantum gravity, so we have issues with that. We don't understand what's going on quite there. So there's a problem, singularity problem. The horizon problem is perhaps the biggest problem, which is if we're looking at cosmic microwave background light, the frequency distribution that we see is basically a measure of the temperature of the universe at the time the light was emitted. If you think about this tie-in between black body radiation and temperature, if something glows, if it's hotter, it glows at a brighter color. And that's a very well understood thing since the days of Planck. So we can look at the intensity of the light coming to us from the cosmic microwave background and calculate the temperature of the universe at the time that light was emitted. And what we find is it's the same that way as it is this way. But the problem we have with that is if you extrapolate back in time in the Big Bang model, light that's emitted to us that far away from this point, those points had not been in causal contact at the time that light had emitted. So how does this part of the universe over here know the temperature it ought to be relative to this type of universe? How can they be the same? The only way we know to do that is to have them in causal contact and basically thermalize, all come to the same temperature. So that is a huge problem in the Big Bang. And the flatness problem I already talked about. So these are major issues scientifically with the idea of the Big Bang. Here's another issue, which is when the Big Bang was discovered, and up until maybe 15 years ago, the Big Bang was actually measured to be completely uniform in its temperature. And within the theory of the Big Bang, in and of itself, if whatever you have starting this expansion happens, we have nothing that gives it any structure. It should be isotropic and smooth. But we live in a universe that has dogs and planets and galaxies and clusters of galaxies. It's clearly not uniform. So what in the Big Bang leads to the so-called large-scale structure of the universe? There is nothing in the theory that does that. Another huge problem. This is a picture taken by the Hubble telescope, basically pointing the Hubble telescope in a single direction for a very long period of time so that it brings in dimmer and dimmer galaxies. And, you know, this little haze right here, that's actually galaxies. And there are associations, clusters of galaxies in here. And so you can actually make maps of the galactic structure as a function of distance and angle, and you can actually determine it. It looks, I mean, it clearly has a lot of filigree structure to it, okay? So there is a lot of structure in our universe at every scale, you know, from the very small, I'm here, to large-scale galactic structure. So this is called the large-scale structure problem. All right, so...
I don't really understand how that's evidence against the Big Bang.
Well, it's evidence against the Big Bang in the sense that the Big Bang theory doesn't explain it. So these are all puzzles that if you take the Big Bang theory in and of itself... First of all, we know it's incomplete because we really don't know what started it there. Or, you know, we have no picture of what's going on right at the start.
Yeah.
But within what we understand about this expanding space, what causes the structure?
Okay.
Something has to, but we have no idea what within that theory.
Contradict the Big Bang. It's just kind of something that the Big Bang theory...
It's pointing out something that is clearly incomplete.
Yeah.
So we have very compelling evidence for the Big Bang picture, and what I hope I'm convincing you of is we have very compelling evidence that there's some serious problems with the whole Big Bang idea in and of itself. Yeah.
How do they have that? I mean, like, this goes back to the kind of the timeline you had laid out before. I think it was the first slide.
Yeah.
How do they know, or how do they have such a strong idea of, you know, what the world was like back then, or what the
I mean, we literally take accelerators and collide particles at energies that were the energies that were present in the universe at that time.
This stuff.
We don't just simulate it, we do it in the lab, and we study the types of particles and the nature of the forces at those times.
Like, we simulate what it would have been like.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can simulate and calculate what would have happened if you lived in a large-scale structure within the equations of general relativity and knowing what types of particles existed and the way their forces were, yeah. Yeah, and that's... That part of it isn't even speculative.
Sure.
All the way back to like 10 to the minus 18, 17 seconds after the Big Bang, because we have literally studied processes back to that time. And the Large Hadron Collider is quite literally trying to push back a little further to answer some unanswered questions we have about some of those details, such as what the Higgs does. We don't know. But But back to that time and that energy, we have a pretty clean picture.
Can you just go into a little further detail of how it gives that environment, it simulates that environment?
Well, so let's not push all the way back to particle physics. I mean, it's the same principle, but when we go back to subatomic particles, I'm starting to spout off about forces and particles that you're just not terribly familiar with. So let's just use the principle of what happens at 400,000 years after the Big Bang. If we take matter as we know it, and we condense it, and we can do this in the lab, okay? And we condense it and we make it hotter and hotter, okay? There comes a point with this matter that it becomes so hot that neutral atoms cannot form. And we will form what we call a plasma. And that happens at about 3,000 degrees. And this is very well understood in the lab. So when I tell you that the plasma at that time was opaque to light, we know that because we make them in the lab. It happens all the time. So that if we had a big volume of that hydrogen gas that we saw that was emitting light to us, if it was a big volume, you wouldn't be able to see through it. You can't image anything out of it because the photons can't go very far. So this is not speculation. We understand it. And so all we're doing is we're saying, we understand through the equations of general relativity, we basically put in the model that you have this big volume with basically, for simplicity, you would assume uniformly distributed matter or clumps locally non-uniform, but basically distributed uniform matter. And you would ask, how does the space evolve? And it turns out that the equations will tell you that it actually will be expanding or contracting, depending on... Okay, so we contract that back, and we can understand what the density of the matter and what the temperature of the matter is as a function of time. And we know what matter does when it's at 3,000 degrees. So we can tell you what the universe must have been like at that time. And we can extrapolate back much further than 300,000 years after the Big Bang, because we actually do have data all the way back to processes that were happening about 10 to the minus 17 seconds after the Big Bang. Right now in the can. When the LHC works fully, we'll actually expand that to about 10 to the minus 18 seconds. So that's how.
Okay.
It is true the processes are different and the forces we have to worry about are different. So, for example, you can't have protons when you get hot enough, but we have studied in the lab the form of matter you get when things are so, the energy density is so high that you can't form protons. It's called a quark-gluon plasma. So if there's one message I would love for you to take away from this class is the amazing feat of science to have actually succeeded to that level. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's arrogant to talk about it as if it is true, but I mean, we truly have data that I mean, it's quite supportable stuff. So a lot of the fun stuff from the point of view of this course happens, what happens earlier in the universe. All this excitement actually happens in the first 10 to the minus 35 seconds, actually. And that's what these guys started to talk about. And the reason that I have to paint all this detail for you is because if I just told you about this idea, which we call cosmic inflation, without convincing you that there are compelling reasons to believe in all these other things and problems with the Big Bang, I don't think you'd take it seriously. I know I didn't. Because this idea is completely wacko. Alan Guth is the one who most people give credit for, but there are other people who played important roles in this along the way, and there are a few that I'll leave out. Basically, Alan Guth was trying to solve a certain problem. There's a certain type of particle, and this may not make any sense if you don't recall, but when we looked at Maxwell's equations, there was an asymmetry between the E fields and the B fields, the magnetic field and the electric field. And that asymmetry boils down to the fact that for electric charge, you have particles that can act as a source of the field. So a positive charge emits electric field lines, a negative charge absorbs the electric field lines. And in magnetism, we have no such thing. We have circular currents that have magnetic fields that go around like that, or you have bar magnets that have magnetic fields going like this. So basically the magnetic field comes in this sort of loop form. And a particle physicist would say what that says is we don't have anything called magnetic monopoles. And Alan Guth was trying to understand why in the world we had no magnetic monopoles, because fundamentally in physics there's no reason for it. And he came up with this completely crazy idea, and when he did, he actually realized he fixed all the problems with the Big Bang in the process. And so the idea was the following. Suppose early on in the universe, when it was enormously energetic, you actually created a high density of these particles called magnetic monopoles. And then you just let this universe totally expand at a superluminal rate, completely unbelievably fast, beyond anything you can imagine. So vastly larger than the observable universe in an instant, basically, very fast. Then the density of the magnetic monopoles would immediately go to zero if you're not creating any more of them, and all of a sudden you put them in a vastly larger box, the density of them becomes negligible. Yeah.
When you talk about, I mean, I don't know, this might sound kind of stupid, but when you talk about like the universe is expanding initially, like what exactly is expanding? Is there like a film around? It's like a bubble.
It's like the space-time itself expands. So I have a sort of a. Okay, this is not a good analogy. I mean, it's an imperfect analogy, but it may help. It makes it. It's not like a grenade exploding out into something, or not like a zit popping. It's like your butt growing when you get older. It sort of grows from within. It's the space-time.
But like,
it's gonna stick now. Okay, I mean, it's
just like outside of that, it's just nothingness. I mean, I guess people don't.
Well, let me go on. I mean, first of all, we don't really know, but people can speculate. Yeah. So, I mean, there are schemes where they can basically create the universe out of nothing. Okay. There are schemes where they legitimately can sort of come up with ways of doing that. Remember, you have coming into play is the sort of world of quantum mechanics, where you can have quantum fluctuations in energy, right? Over a very short period of time, if you pick a little bit of space, your knowledge of that energy of that space is not so great. So you can actually have things come into play for short periods of time and go away and have it be quite consistent with quantum mechanics. It turns out that if you have that happen, there are ways to imbue that space-time with a vastly repulsive character which can cause this thing to expand dramatically. And that's basically what these guys did. So the idea with cosmic inflation is that the universe started out really small. So exactly in what? We'll talk a little bit more, but of course I don't have an answer. But imagine that you have an energy fluctuation. So you have a little bit of space-time, there's some energy in it, and the nature of the space-time, we've talked about the Higgs field a little bit, how mathematically you describe particles basically as a mathematical field existing at all points. You can hypothesize a type of particle that exists called an inflaton, which is a generic term because we really don't have any idea what type of particle it was. But you can create a field within the space-time of this universe that is slightly excited when it comes into being. I mean, what I mean by that is over time the field will sink to a ground state. So a way to think about it is if instead of a field you think of a spring coming into existence, if the spring comes into existence and it is at its natural length, not stretched out, then you would say that it's at its ground state. So if instead the spring sort of is created and it's already stretched a little bit, you have physically a slightly different situation. It turns out that if we have this universe come into being, with a type of particle at something of an excited state, when it happens, it'll actually create a term in the equations that will cause a massive repulsion happening in the space-time. This mechanism can be done in different ways. It isn't really that important in our class. What I really want you to understand in terms of this class is that in quantum field theory, as people sort of understand it, there are ways to cobble together mechanisms where space-time can have a characteristic such that you have this massive expansion property. And you can actually... I'll get to it. You can even conserve energy under this under this scenario. So if you just bear with me for a minute, what Alan Guth and his friends said is that the universe starts out really small. Everything is in causal contact. You have quantum fluctuations going on inside this thing, even though it in and of itself is sort of a quantum fluctuation. What I mean by that is picture some small region of space and time where you can have small asymmetries in energy because of the quantum fluctuations. This now expands to be vastly larger than the observable universe at the time over a very, very short period of time. So from something like 10 to the minus 44 seconds after the start of whatever this fluctuation was to somewhere around 10 to the minus 35 seconds after, you have this so-called, or this period of 10 to the minus 37 to 10 to the minus 35 or so, you have what is called inflation. All of a sudden, if the space had curvature, which you think it must have had in general relativity, and you now take it and you blow it up to be vastly larger than anything you can imagine, whatever was curved will appear to be flat. So just like if you have a beach ball and you blow it up to be the size of the Earth and you look at the surface, it will appear flat, just like the surface of the Earth appears flat to us on a large, you know, on a large scale, as long as you don't go too large. So this idea of inflation, for example, takes whatever the geometry of the universe was and drives it toward being flat. So there's a natural explanation for why the universe space is flat. It starts out small. Everything is thermalized. And now you blow up way big. That means that this part of the universe and that part of the universe start out at the same temperature. So, as they evolve and they emit the light that became cosmic microwave background, when we see it, we will see it to be the same temperature over here as it is here. So that explains the horizon problem. Large-scale structure of the universe. If you have this small region of space-time with quantum processes going on, and you now blow it up to be really big all of a sudden, the small energy asymmetries in that space are all of a sudden blown from quantum size to cosmic size and larger than cosmic size. And this effectively breaks Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in the sense that it freezes these quantum fluctuations in our universe. These regions, then, what it tells you is that the temperature of the cosmic microwave background should not be completely uniform. It should have slight structure to it. There should be slightly hot spots and slightly cool spots because you should have quantum fluctuations in the space-time as you blow it up. Those structures, where it was hot, you should get a little bit more hydrogen forming. Where you get a little more hydrogen forming, gravity will pull it together. You'll get more stars, more galaxies, and this will naturally account for the basic structure that we see in our universe. So this picture gives you a way to get the large-scale structure of the universe. In this picture, you have this superluminal expansion, and then the field, which was put in an excited state, which causes this expansion, whatever this picture is, it basically relaxes. So the spring sort of comes together as this thing is expanding. When that happens, inflation actually slows down, and the energy that was stored in this field gets dumped into matter and radiation, and it basically gives you the starting point of the Big Bang. So the idea of this cosmic inflation is that it maps maps by about 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the start of the Big Bang. This fluctuation that undergoes inflation maps directly onto our model of the Big Bang But now you have all these little problems fixed. So it sounds pretty crazy. I think I've left out one or two of the problems of the Big Bang, so let's see what we've got. All right, so let me step through, and this is basically for your notes. I will be included on the web. So you start small, you know, exactly in what, who knows, and we're not going to worry about too much. People do worry about it, but... So you have some very small fluctuation. This is extremely small, smaller than any subatomic particle that we know about. There is a way to imbue space-time such that you will have this massively fast, unstable repulsion. There are different ways to make it happen. Generically, people talk about an inflaton field, not so important for what we're doing, but we don't know exactly the mechanism, and maybe someday if we truly have evidence for exactly, if once we have hard evidence that inflation really happened, and we do have some evidence that points to it, as I'll show you, then people will start arguing about what kind of inflation, what kind of model, what mechanism actually happened, but we're not there yet. So, okay, so this is all something I already said. So you might worry about energy conservation. It turns out that within this crazy scheme, and it does sound crazy, you, as you have the space grow, you're effectively forming space and energy in this region as it's growing. And at the same time, if you're literally having energy over here and energy over here, they'll gravitationally attract. And so as this thing is expanding, if you actually keep track of the energy budget, you have the kinetic energy of this expansion, and it turns out that the potential energy of literally creating gravitating mass or gravitating energy and making it go farther and farther away actually comes into the energy budget with a negative sign. So it turns out that these actually can cancel, so that you can do this really wacky mechanism without actually breaking energy conservation, as strange as it sounds. So Alan Guth is one of the things he said that sticks with me is he says the universe is the ultimate free lunch, because the scheme basically allows you to do that. So it turns out that energy conservation is not a big issue with this, even though that should strike you as very strange. All right, so if you start out as something basically a quantum fluctuation, well, we sort of deal with that kind of stuff in quantum mechanics all the time. So in a sense, you're starting out with something that's of a size that we've sort of dealt with, and you avoid the singularity. So the singularity problem with the Big Bang goes away. The flatness problem goes away because no matter what the geometry was to begin with, you blow up big enough, the universe, the geometry will be driven to flatness. The horizon problem goes away because you start small, everything's thermalized, so that this part of the universe and that part of the universe should be at the same temperature, even though in the Big Bang, when you don't have this inflationary idea, you have no way of bringing them into causal contact. But when you include inflation, they start out in causal contact, and then it more or less immediately are what we would perceive as outside of causal contact. And then you have the structure, because you have energy density fluctuations in the early stage that get blown up to large-scale structure. How are we doing? All right, so let me stop there for just a minute. Okay, so this sounds completely crazy. It is our cosmological paradigm right now. This is the leading theory of how our universe came into being. And we're going to proceed in a bit, and I will actually say there is actually some evidence that supports even the inflationary part of this. To first order, the Big Bang piece of it is very well supported experimentally. The prior to the Big Bang piece is a little dicier, but it does make some pretty firm predictions, and I'm going to show you why this is taken so seriously, but I sort of want to let this sink in for just a moment, give you a chance to ask questions if you want. Yes?
What's the singularity problem here?
Basically, if I take all the energy in the universe, or even if I take a small amount, and I have it collapse into itself, I get infinite energy density. I get a certain amount of energy in an infinitesimally small spot. So the energy density goes...
So that's the same thing as black holes.
Yep. Yep, yeah, the same problem that you have with black holes, except on a bigger scale. Yeah.
And when you said that before the Big Bang, it's a little dicier, like what experiments have been done to support that? Like you said there's a lot of...
All right, we're headed that way, so just bear with me on that. Okay? Okay, so... So I'm going to paint some of this as we go, but I can tell you a few pieces to give you a little bit of a heads up on what's coming. In the last 10 to 15 years, we have discovered a lot of amazing things about our universe. So this is, I mean, the ink is hardly dry on these papers, right? I mean, this is really amazing stuff. One thing that has happened is that satellites have been sent up and experiments have been done that have an enormous sensitivity to be able to distinguish slight differences in the color of the cosmic microwave background. That is, they can look for slight temperature differences in the early universe. The first one that detected these differences is called the COBE satellite. Since then, one that has even more sensitivity was sent up called WMAP. And these two satellites, and I'll show you pictures of what they've seen shortly, have seen that there are slight color variations in the cosmic microwave background at the level of about 1 part in 10 to the 5th. Right? So that's basically saying it's 90.00000 degrees here, and in Albany it's 90.00001. And you might think, who the hell cares? But that slight variation in temperature is the thing that leads to the large-scale structure of the universe. So if you were a believer in the Big Bang, that structure had to be there. People went absolutely bonkers when this was discovered. It was a huge thing. Right, because we had all this data supporting the Big Bang, but everything looked completely smooth, which is really in complete conflict. Once this asymmetry was discovered, the large-scale structure, we know where it came from. Okay, at 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the asymmetry was there in terms of the color differences, in terms of the temperature differences. Another thing that has happened, and I'll show you how this happened, by looking at the sizes of the different colored regions on the cosmic microwave background as you look up at the sky, we've been able to determine that the geometry of the universe is basically flat. So I've sort of stated that that was a given, but that was an interesting measurement to do, and I will show you how that was determined. And then on the scale of things we've been talking about, a few years ago, something came totally out of the blue that caught everybody off guard. And that is, as people did more careful measurements of the expansion rate of the universe as a function of time, by just basically repeating Hubble's measurements but doing it further and further out and more precisely, we have determined that not only is our universe expanding, But it is not doing what you would have naively expected, which is we have this big mass of energy and gravity, and so the universe's space is expanding. Clearly, it should be slowing down. It's not. It's actually speeding up. The expansion rate of our universe appears to be increasing. And that completely came out of the blue. So I'll talk a bit more about that. Yes. Too.
Why is that so surprising?
Because as the universe is expanding, if the mechanism of inflation has sort of decayed away, you basically now have this expanding region of space-time that's basically a bunch of matter and energy, which, according to general relativity, is basically pulling in on itself. So there should be a net force inward as this thing is expanding. So the expansion rate should actually be slowing down. And it should be either the expansion is going so fast that we don't have enough matter to actually stop it, and it just keeps expanding, but it shouldn't be speeding up. Or it should go and just basically come to rest at infinity. Or it should do this. But under no circumstances should it be accelerating.
It doesn't, I mean, this may be very naive, but like, just because, you know, it started accelerating, there's no medium to slow it down when it just continued to accelerate and get faster.
Well, no, something has to drive it. Something has to drive that.
Past the initial, like, you know.
Yeah. Because something in motion remains in motion until,
right.
So unless you have a force happening now, you will not accelerate the expansion. So the idea of inflation is you have this quantum fluctuation and you have this weird thing, whatever it is, the inflaton field, that starts out in a state that basically provides this repulsive force in the space-time, and the thing gets great big. In the meantime, as it gets big, the inflaton field actually changes its character and that force disappears. And so when it does, that energy gets dumped in the matter, into particles and radiation, and we have basically what is our current, what we see as the Big Bang. And so we have this expanding universe, but basically there's nothing continuing that expansion at that time. It's just sort of continuing with where it was, but it's just, okay. And now what I'm saying is that even today, there is some sort of mechanism in our space-time that is causing a continuing repulsive force. So this expansion rate is actually increasing. We do not know what that mechanism is. And I'm going to talk more and more about it. You can make it happen. When you write down Einstein's equations that describe the basic universe, you can have different terms. You can have a term that's, you know, all the normal matter in the universe, which is causing an attraction. There is a term that you can put in the equation which can cause a force of expansion. And people call it the cosmological constant term. You can create such a thing by, for example, having a field that is at a slightly excited state in your equation. So that's how people do it for inflation. It's an energy term in the equations. It has the units of energy. So we call this generically dark energy, and we don't know the source of it. But there is some mechanism in our universe right now that is causing the universe's acceleration to, the universe's expansion rate to accelerate. And we don't know what it is. Yes?
If it's accelerating, wouldn't that mean the space-time is kind of curved, like something is accelerating?
If all we had in play was normal matter, and you had it expanding in this way, yes. if it were, well, no. There's no mechanism, if all you have there in the play is to there's no mechanism to accelerate the expansion. What you can have is if the expansion is so great it will never stop, that would be negatively curved space. If the expansion rate is such that it's going to stop, slow down, and come back, that would be positively curved space. And if it goes out to infinity and stops, that would be flat space. So there's a way to correlate the geometry to the future of the universe if you have nothing else at play. But it turns out that things are more complicated than that. We know the geometry of the universe is flat, and we have another mechanism, and we do not know what it is yet, which is causing an accelerating expansion of space. So, yes?
If the universe is expanding and everything is just getting further further away from each other, can that be seen on a local scale? Is our solar system expanding?
Not really, because gravity is strong enough locally to sort of hold things together.
So it's really more like galaxies are expanding.
Yeah. So if we were to extrapolate immediately into the far future of the universe and look out at the night sky, Basically what we would see is our galaxy would be alone.
Yeah.
Or our local cluster of galaxies would sort of be alone. That's a way to think about it. Okay, so lots of strange things are coming down the pike. Here is the surprise of discovering the accelerating expansion of the universe. So this is a complicated graph. So let's see. This is a measure of the recession velocity of the galaxy, and this is a measure of the brightness. So this is a modern version of the Hubble plot that you've already seen. And here's the data scattered. And because we're talking about vast times, we have the data. We can only see so far out. And people are doing experiments to see further and further out. But here's the data. And we have, different histories of the universe plotted. So universes that, here's one where it's going to go out and come back like that. That would be something that would look like this. Then we have ideas of some that were decelerated but then expand forever. So basically, these futures are the ones we thought could exist. Either something collapses or expands forever or sort of comes to a stop. But what we actually see, it turns out, is that we're on a curve that provides for acceleration in here. We don't exactly fit on these sort of reddish curves where the histories that we were expecting happen to be. I'm not going to throw this on a test and have you guys explain it all, but I did want to show you the basic data so you can see. There are experiments set up to take more data out here to sort of pin this down a little bit better. Here is the first picture of the structure in the cosmic microwave background. And what we have before you is, if I were to take a picture of the full night sky and basically unroll it, okay? And this is what the COBE experiment, the COBE satellite, first saw in 1992. COBE stands for Cosmic Microwave Background Explorer. And what has happened is that the night sky, the sky is basically all at one temperature except for at about 1 part in 10 to the 5th. And at that level, if you're on this side of 1 part in 10 to the 5th, it's sort of colored pink. If you're on that side, it's colored blue. So the color color variation dramatically changes for your eye, the actual temperature variation. But it gives you an idea of the fact that if your eye were sensitive at that level and you could see the color of the cosmic microwave background and all the stars and everything else went away, this would be what the night sky would sort of look like to you. This actually happens to be taken with an experiment that needed glasses. It was actually the best at the time and was a fantastic breakthrough. But it's a little bit like you walked outside and you were very nearsighted and you looked over at Rush Reese. What you would see is sort of this big fuzzy blob, but you wouldn't be able to see your friend standing in the window. You might or might not see the windows very clearly, although you would see them as sort of dark blobs, okay? I can see that very clearly because for many years until I had LASIK about 5-6 years ago, I had always been very nearsighted. In 2003, a different satellite was sent up that didn't need glasses and was able to take a much better picture of the cosmic microwave background. And that's what you see here. So you can see now the structure and the filigrees in much more detail. And this was known as the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. And this is actually the picture, in a sense, this is a picture of the structure in the Big Bang, the temperature variations in the Big Bang about 10 to the minus, about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And this variation maps, or stuff just like this, maps directly into the large-scale structure of the universe. So you should be able to correlate the sizes of these different regions into sizes of correlated structure in our universe today. If we were to map, for example, the very small spots and the very large spots, and we were then to go out and look at small galactic clusters and large galactic clusters, that mapping is more or less, the frequency of these things should be about the same. Do you have a question? Okay. And in fact, that is holds great clues for what's happening in the universe at the early stages. So I mentioned that we can measure the geometry of the universe. It turns out that within the ideas of inflation and the early stages of the Big Bang, people have pretty good ideas as to how big these different colored regions ought to be, or at least how big the biggest ones could be. Okay, and I'm not going to bore you with the theoretical motivation for that. But let us suppose that we're basically looking at light emitted from, you know, that distance, some 13.2 billion years away, light years away. And we know from our picture of how things should work what the size of the larger spots ought to be. Then we can go and look at the actual angular size of the large spots. And if the universe's space is flat, then that angular size is calculable, and it should be sort of like this angle. So that means we look at that spot, and it should, you know, subtend a certain angle to our eye. If it subtends a much larger angle, it actually shows us that the space in the universe has positive curvature, because basically from that distance away, the light more or less follows this sort of path, so that when it comes to us, it should appear to be bigger. If it comes to us and it appears to be smaller, it's evidence for negative curvature of the space. And it turns out that we see something that looks very much like flat space. So a way to think about it is the following. Literally, we're looking at the sizes of the spots, the larger spots, on the cosmic microwave background that we see. And in the case of the geometry of the universe being sort of like this, negative, those spots should look sort of smallish. In the case where it's positive, they should look bigger. And in the case where it's flat, they'll look about like that. And so when we go and we look, we actually see they look like this. And so this is a direct experimental measure of the curvature of the space of our universe. So earlier when I said we believe it's flat, here's one of the reasons why. Okay. Crap. I'm out of time. All right. We are right now on the threshold of the multiverse. We finally have the background that I can give you the most compelling evidence for multiple universes. But we're going to do that Wednesday, I guess. So.